This talk is entitled Why Philosophers Need Truth Makers, and I noticed a connection in the conference I hadn't been anticipating in Simon's talk. If you look on his handout, Rorty informs us that there is no such relation as truth making. So that's my starting point. We have an enemy. Okay. Verificationism was a well-known attempt by empiricist philosophers in the 1920s to set up a principle which would weed the waffle out of philosophy by revealing that many plausible statements were actually meaningless. The idea was to set up a criterion for being meaningful, which was by having, in some way, a connection to actual experience. If some claim failed this test, it could be swept aside, even though it might appear to have made a genuine claim. The sentence, "God is love," was offered as an example of a widely used sentence which actually meant nothing. It is a familiar fact that verificationism failed to achieve its goals because counterexamples were constructed to their principle, and the verification principle itself seemed to be meaningful without being verifiable. The clearest problem, I would say, is that fanciful speculations, such as those concerning what happened before the Big Bang, are clearly perfectly meaningful, even if there is no chance at all of verification. A huge range of English statements are in fact thoroughly meaningful, despite having no good connection to actual experience. Philosophers have given up dismissing widely expressed ideas as being meaningless. But in the process, they've also given up on a rather good project, which was to weed the waffle out of philosophy. I want to suggest in this talk that this tough approach to bad philosophy would have been more successful if they had focused on truth rather than on meaning. Achieving meaning is a very modest goal, often achieved by tiny infants and parrots. But achieving truth is much more demanding and cries out for a rigorous test if we could devise one. It seems to me that the modern concept of a truth maker is just what is needed for this role. I do not say that there is a full and finished theory of truth-making available, which can immediately take on the task of sifting out philosophical waffle, but I do say that all philosophers should take truth-making seriously and look for ways to clarify the idea and deal with its problems. I certainly think that the occasional casual dismissals of truth-making found in the literature are absurd. I'll first sketch the theory, then address the relatively minor problems of the nature of truth itself, the nature of the bearers of truth, and how we should characterize truth makers in general. We need to get through those quickly in order to tackle the two biggest issues, which are how to characterize the truth-making relationship and how to deal with the difficult cases of truths which have very elusive truth makers. If I say, "I am sitting," and I am indeed sitting, then I hope we can agree that what I said is true. If I then stand up, which one, and say, "I'm sitting," then my statement has become false. The truth value of my sentence tracks my physical position. If I ask why my sentence is true, or what makes it true, then citing that physical position is the only possible answer. We can add that, given the meaning of the English sentence, "I am sitting," plus my sedentary position, the sentence has to be true. That is, the truth is necessitated by how things are. This is the simple idea that sentence has a truth maker. The truth maker theory proposes to universalize this observation and makes two bold claims. One, that sentences can only be true if they have truth makers, i.e. that all true sentences have truth makers, and two, that the truth of every sentence is necessitated by its truth maker. If you agree about the sentence, "I am sitting," but disagree about the big bold theory, then the obvious challenge you face is why a theory which is obviously correct for a simple observation sentence could turn out to be false for other types of sentence. It would seem odd that there are two fundamentally different ways for sentences to be true. A second potential reaction on first hearing the proposal is to say that it is correct, but it doesn't say very much. Indeed, it does not say very much. Only that if you assert the truth of something, you'd better believe that there is something which makes it true. If you admit that there is no such thing, then the proposal says you should probably back off. But then that is a fairly normal principle applied in law courts. You are, of course, entitled to say, this seems to be true, even though I have no idea what makes it true. But the truthmaker principle says, if you are going to maintain that truth, then you must believe that something makes it true, even though you don't know what the truthmaker is. What you are no longer permitted to say is, this is true, even though nothing whatever makes it true. I like the principle, because it at least offers readily acceptable grounds for rejecting truths of folklore and media consensus which have no sort of basis at all. And it also motivates a philosophical project to fully specify the truth-makers of the human conceptual scheme. Truth-making is probably best understood as a principle of meta-philosophy rather than of immediate philosophical inquiry. The theory starts to say more if you become more specific about how truth-making works. If you proposed that the only truth-makers there could possibly be are found A, in God's will, or B, in Platonic ideas, or C, in physical material, or D, in subjective experience, then you would have four dramatically different philosophies which all obeyed the truth-maker principle. To grasp the truth-making principle, it is important to distinguish it from the correspondence theory of truth, to which it obviously bears similarities. Both discuss truth in terms of some sort of truth-bearers, such as propositions, and some features of reality to which they refer, such as facts or states of affairs. The most important difference between the two ideas is that the correspondence theory offers an account of the nature of truth, or even a definition of it. But the truth-maker principle does not. The correspondence theory says that truth is the relation of correspondence between the truth-bearer and whatever it refers to. The truth-maker principle is neutral about the actual nature of truth, and it is quite common to treat truth as a primitive concept within the theory. When something is a primitive in a philosophical theory, that either means that the concept is self-evident to most of us, but cannot be explained further, or it means that the concept is a placeholder which is only understood in terms of its rules and behaviour. Many truth-maker theorists see truth as a self-evident primitive. The axiomatic theory of truth treats it as a mere placeholder, which is only understood through the rules of its behaviour. Truth-making might also accept a minimal linguistic account of truth, or even the pragmatic theory. A second important distinction between truth-making and correspondence is that truth-making is a one-way relation, and correspondence is a two-way relation. This implies that correspondence is a one-to-one relation, but that creates a problem. Suppose I'm looking at a crowd of people, and the crowd contains two of my friends, and I say, I have a friend in that crowd. It seems that the correspondence theory says that I've uttered two truths, because truth is correspondence, and there are two correspondences in the situation, in which my sentence corresponds first to friend one, and second to friend two. The truth-maker view is that I've uttered a single truth, because the sentence has a truth-maker. Luckily it has two truth-makers, but they both do the same job of making my sentence true. One truth can have several truth-makers, and one truth-maker can make several truths. In this example, the flexibility of truth-making seems to give a better account than the strictness of correspondence. The correspondence theory has two further notorious problems concerning the correspondence relation and the relatum at the reality end of the relation, usually called the fact. For the relation to qualify as correspondence, there must be ingredients of the truth-bearer which match up with ingredients of the fact. Without such a mapping of ingredients, the theory doesn't seem to say any more than that the sentence is true. Russell gave the example of Othello believes that Desdemona loves Cassio. and said that if your theory includes the two relations, believes and loves, with each relation having a direction, then a map of the sentence fits a map of the facts, if the sentence is true. This is called the congruence account of the correspondence theory of truth. The theory seems to work well for Russell's example, since there is a fairly clear correspondence between the sentence and reality. And you can say that the sentence is true if all the elements of the congruence get a tick. If I say the sun looks circular, there is also a correspondence with the object, the quality, and their mutual relation. However, other examples don't look so good. It seems a good theory for true statements about specific structured facts. But even then, there may be more structure in the sentence than in the fact if I talk about electrons, or less structure in the sentence than in the fact if I make a simple remark about the European economy. It gets worse if the fact doesn't seem to have a structure, or doesn't contain clear objects or relations. General truths, negative truths, vague truths, and fictional truths are much harder than the Othello example to fit into the correspondence theory. And much of Russell's career was devoted to battling with such problems. Even more drastically, we might object that there can't be a correspondence between a proposition and a part of reality because they are in two entirely different types of thing. The third problem for correspondence, apart from the problem of one sentence being several truths and the problem with clarifying the correspondence relation, is how we should understand what a fact is. The two problems here are vagueness and potential circularity. The question, how many facts are there in this room, reveals the first difficulty, especially if we permit negative facts, disjunctive facts, like this or that, and conjunctive facts, this and that. The only solution seems to be identifying the fact with what the sentence is about. But that leads to the circularity problem, because what the sentence is about only becomes a fact if the sentence is true. But that begs the very question we're trying to answer of what true means. These are some of the reasons why the intuitively attractive and common sense correspondence theory of truth has proved a great frustration for analytic philosophers who dream of rigour and precision. The aim of truth-maker theory is not so much to solve these problems as to evade them by the simple expedient of making more modest claims. The question of the bearer of truth is worrisome for all students of truth. But I will simply assert that propositions are what bear truth, even if proposition is not a very precise term. It covers what a sentence means, even if expressed in several different ways or in different languages, and also the contents of non-linguistic thoughts, even in the minds of animals that lack language. I take it as axiomatic that most animals with good-sized brains can have both correct and incorrect thoughts, and so any account of truth must embrace that fact. We saw that facts were a rather elusive component of the correspondence theory. But truth-maker theory will also need some way of characterising the kinds of things which make a proposition true. They don't need the kind of structure needed to enter into a precise correspondence relation, so all they need is some sort of existence that is independent of the proposition in question. David Armstrong, whose book on truth-making is the Old Testament of the subject, suggested calling the truth-makers states of affairs, and we can accept this for now. The difficulties of the correspondence theory should make us look ahead to problem cases, such as the truths of maths and logic. And states of affairs are flexible enough to cover most of those cases, while having enough content to make sense in ordinary conversation. We now have the framework of truth-maker theory in place. We can treat truth itself as indefinable, but intuitively obvious, and say that all true propositions are necessarily made true by some state of affairs. This brings us to the hard part, which is to say what the truth-maker relation is, and then give some account of the tricky cases. An early suggestion for the truth-maker relation was that, since it evidently involved necessity, It might be the relationship of logical entailment. Thus, if I am sitting down, then this logically necessitates that I am sitting is true. And if I say, I am standing, I seem to contradict my actual sedentary state of affairs. However, this proposal seems to be wrong, for the simple reason that people sitting in chairs don't enter into logical relations, which are entirely a matter of the relationship between propositions. One sentence can entail another sentence, but physical objects don't have powers of entailment. So, if logic is not doing the necessitating, then what is doing it? I can't answer that question, but it seems to involve the obscure problem of the content of propositions. Truth makers relate to what a proposition is about, and that seems to involve the idea of representation. The sentence, I am sitting, represents the world as being a certain way, which is often called the truth conditions of the sentence. This seems to be an imaginative picture of the state of affairs when the sentence is true. You might immediately fear another circularity here if we invoke truth to explain truth-making, but remember that we are not trying to define truth, but are treating it as a given so we can draw on the concept whenever necessary. We can't be happy with the idea of a picture, of course, because much of our talk does not picture anything, but at least we understand the idea that propositions represent things. But where does the necessitating come from? Truth-making is, remember, a one-way relationship. If I observe that I am sitting, and then say, I am sitting, you might say that I have produced the necessity of the truth by correctly describing the situation. But that doesn't seem right. I can't impose truth or necessity on my sentence. I can only offer my sentence to reality and wait to see if reality makes it true. We can only ask what the power of the situation is that enables it to necessitate a truth. And we might offer locutions such as the intrinsic nature of the situation to do that job. I personally like two words that bring us close to what we are trying to describe. The first is that my sedentary position grounds the sentence, the truth of the sentence, which means something like an unspoken reason for the sentence to be true. That word ought at least to appeal to philosophers who are devoted to understanding the reasons that structure the world. The second word is that the situation determines the truth of the sentence. I like this word because we can say that something is necessitated because it is caused, as when a falling brick necessitates a loud bang. And we might be tempted to say that truth makers cause truths. However, this does not fit mathematics very well when we say that some equation necessitates specific values for its variables, as when 2x equals 4 necessitates x being 2. The word determines does seem to cover this nicely, and so I'm inclined to see physical necessity and mathematical necessity as two different forms of the determination relation. Hence, I will say that truth makers determine the truths of sentences which successfully say something about their states of affairs. I'm not deluding myself that this fishing for an appropriate vocabulary is solving any deep problems, but I do think finding the right vocabulary is very important for philosophy, because it can be extended into other areas of the subject where badly chosen vocabulary breaks down. So I will settle for saying that every true proposition is grounded by some state of affairs which determines its truth. To that, we can add that because of the grounding relation, the truth can be said to depend on its truth maker, since removal of the truth maker deprives the proposition of its truth, and also say that a truth is true in virtue of its truth maker, which points to the intrinsic nature of the state of affairs. This leads us into thinking that the truth maker might explain the truth, so that if you ask for an explanation of Peter is sitting, you might reply, well, just look at him. I hope you can see that I'm trying to fit truth makers into a network of related concepts which will give us the tools to think properly about the world. Let me now turn briefly to the best known problem case for truth makers, which is negative truths. If you say, Peter is sitting, I'm present to do the truth making job. If you say, Peter is not here, your sentence seems to be about here, wherever that is, but I am not present to do the required necessitating. Lots of truths seem to take this negative form. So, without a plausible account of their truth makers, our whole theory is thrown into doubt. Consider one solution. If I say, Marianne is in Scotland, I believe that to be true, and to have an unproblematic truth maker in her presence in Scotland. If I get your agreement that Oxford is not in Scotland, and that people can't be in two places at once, we can infer the truth, Marianne is not in Oxford. Might we say that the truth maker for Marianne is not in Oxford is also her presence in Scotland, on the grounds that the truth maker for any true proposition will also determine the truth of all the implications of the first proposition. If we add that logical implication is a necessary relation, we can retain the necessity of the truth making. That looks promising, until we consider three further truths. That Socrates is not in Oxford, that my great-great-grandchild is not in Oxford, and that Bilbo Baggins is not in Oxford. Truths which refer to past, future, and fictional persons. These suggest that their truth makers should be the current state of Oxford, which suggests that the truth maker for Marianne is not in Oxford should also be Oxford rather than Scotland. That in turn suggests that the implications of a true proposition need their own truth maker and can't sponge off the grounding of the parent truth. I think that should read. That in turn suggests the implications of a false proposition need their own truth. But anyway, I'll let you know what the correct version is. Pardon? I'm not confident about this. I'll let you know at the tea break. There are two ways to go here. We could treat all negative truths as parasitic on the positive truths, so that positive truths have straightforward truth makers, such as Marianne being in Scotland. And then the negative truths don't really count as proper truths and are confined to a menial role in our conceptual scheme. Or we could find a way to characterize negative states of affairs to do the job, containing features such as absences, which speak of the absence of Marianne and Bilbo Baggins in Oxford. This still has to deal with sentences such as, there are no hobbits, which seems to make the entire universe its negative state of affairs. But maybe we have to bite that bullet. Personally, I rather favour the first approach, although it is quite radical. That's the one that says, proper truths are the positive ones. That is, the primary truths are that which say how the world is, and denials of how the world is count as secondary. Normally the word not is taken to flip truth values backwards and forwards between true and false, seeing them as symmetrical. The view that negations of the primary truths have a secondary status would break that symmetry. This might point to a logic built on true and not true, rather than on true and false. That's as far as I've got on that one, so the debate remains open. My conclusion is that truth-making is a powerful and important idea for philosophy. I started by offering it as a waffle detector that might do a better job than verificationism, but it is clearly not a sharp and rigorous tool and merely offers a helpful aid in focusing sensible philosophical discussion. What I really like about truth-making arises from the fact that most truth-makers also possess truth-makers. And so there is a hierarchy of truth-making in our successful theories of reality which matches the hierarchical structure, such as physics, then chemistry, then biology, that we find in the world. Hence, the reason why philosophers need truth-makers is in order to do philosophy properly, And my suspicion is that without a commitment to truth makers, the entire subject collapses into waffle.
Touched on this towards the end in what you called hierarchy that seemed to be possibly a circularity. As soon as you are asked what is the truth maker of the proposition you've just made, all you do is advance another proposition, and I don't see how you escape from the further question you raised. Okay, what makes your truth maker true, etc., etc., etc.? Is there not just an infinite regress rather than a hierarchy?
Yes, it sounds to me as if you're accusing truth-making of the thing that I accuse the correspondence theory of, that when you try and state the fact, all you're doing is stating a true sentence. I'm going to appeal to my original example. If someone says, Peter is sitting, you say something like, well, what makes that true? A reasonable reply is not, well, Peter is sitting, which obviously sounds a bit circular. You could just say, look, you know, point to the stage, and then you would say, oh, I see, you know. So it's perfectly able to break out, I think, of your circle by just referring to experience, and that's ultimately what the truth-making is doing, is referring to an unarticulated experience. I mean, I do say I'm trying to get a story which will fit animals who don't have sentences, but I think they have some sort of thoughts, you know. But they don't. When you say to a dog, you know, what makes that sentence true, it doesn't reply with another sentence. It says, you know, sort of, will that do? I don't know.
I've been used to thinking in terms of truth conditions of statements. You want truth makers because there's something in the world which has the sort of relation you're explaining. Take a statement, I'm not very good at astronomy, but there are seven planets, if that's what I want to say. It was true. The conditions were such that you could count all seven, including Pluto. And then the astronomers changed the definition of planet, and it was no longer true. There were then only six planets. Nothing has changed in the world. But it's still the statement now has different truth conditions. That's what the word planet is now defined to mean. And it seems to me that is a better analysis of how and therefore you're focusing on the tests that are applied in applying this statement in accordance with these conventions, which are what people are trying to convey in language and have learned to convey and conventionally can relay. All that is linguistic, and the truth maker seems to me to blur the distinction between how we get at it and what the underlying facts in the world are.
Yeah, that's quite a lot there. I don't think the truth conditions theory of meaning is in competition with what I'm saying. And they could be made complementary. In fact, I'm aware that there's a sort of problem here, but I think I might be able to pinch your theory and dovetail it into mine or something. The planets thing, I don't see the problem with planets. You say there are nine planets and there were nine planets, and then one day you read the newspapers and you find there are now only seven planets. It sounds like we've changed the truth conditions of the sentence because we've redefined the word planet. But having changed the truth condition of the sentence, we now say there are seven planets. We ascertain the meaning by, as far as I can see, just picturing how the world would be, getting the conditions in which this would be true. But that doesn't make it true. So now you need my theory. If you say, "Ooh, it seems to be true," why is that? And I say, "Well, there are seven bodies out here. But here's the definition of planet. I'm afraid Pluto's out. Here's the seven bodies, and they make it true. And without those planets, you're sunk."
Maybe they're not inconsistent, but the making is done on the linguistic side rather than the reality side.
What, the making of the truth?
Yeah.
Well, I'm claiming otherwise. My example is standing up, you know, that if you say Peter is sitting, I am falsifying your sentence.
But the astronomy hasn't changed, except in terminology.
Yes, but somewhere I said something about what the sentence is about, and you're giving an example where what the sentence is about has been shifted by fiat by someone. Mm. So you've got two different examples in the two different
systems.
I'm adhering to propositions, so as far as I'm concerned, you've got two entirely different propositions there.
We have got quite a few questions coming out. Mark.
Well, to some extent, I also echo what Alan was talking about. Because as far as I'm concerned, we are simply shifting the problem from one corner of the room to another corner of the room. Because, you know, how do you establish what the state of affairs is? For example, okay, then you may or may not agree that you are sitting. Is what we are sitting? I have no idea. So, do tell me, is what we are sitting? Then have a look at that.
I'm not sure. Let's say I'm not sure. And that's why I'm not sure whether the sentence is true, precisely because I'm not sure of the state of affairs that's supposed to make it true.
Well, fair enough. But of course, that brings up another problem. In such a case, if that is your answer, I do not follow why you differentiate, and it's probably needed, but why you differentiate the state of affairs where something is absent from the state of affairs where something is present. Surely, Marianne is. Not in Oxford, is Bruce made in your terms by the fact that Marianne is not in Oxford. She isn't. You cannot, you know, however much you survey at Oxford, you are not going to find her there. What is the difference? Why do you need the difference in such a case?
Right. Well, that's tricky. This will be a long answer, which I'm not allowed to give. Towards the end, I'm not sure is the answer. Don't know, really. But the thing I'm fishing for is I said something about distinguishing between being false and being not true. It just occurs to me that if I really go for this theory, it's actually, I'm trying to say I'm completely neutral about what truth is, but I'm actually beginning to think I'm probably not, because this theory will give you a story of what truth is, and truth is something which it's open. All truths are made true by something. So Marianne is not in Oxford. I mean, the relevant facts are what's going on. Presumably Cambridge is not relevant to the discussion. So the relevant facts are, we can say there's one state of affairs, which is Oxford here, Marianne there, and call that one state of affairs. Or you can say there's one state of affairs, she's there, and that's not Oxford or something. So it's a kind of inference about Oxford from there. Or you can say that Oxford is the state of affairs, the absence of Marianne. Then, of course, it wouldn't matter where Marianne is. But so that is another thing, because I'm saying that in some way, if we're going to say Marianne is not in Oxford, is a truth, and I'm not sure I'm prepared to accept it, since it sounds more like a denial of a truth. But if you're going to say that, then I want a specific truth maker for it. But of course, the fact that Marianne is in Scotland is somewhat sort of truth maker. But if Marianne had been in Northern Ireland, it would have been an entirely different fact and it would have done the job. And then if Marianne had been on Mars, it would have done the job as well. And sort of you lose a grip on the notion of truth maker. So you're putting a finger on the most difficult part of the story. So that's why I'm voting for the beginning, the first of the two options near the end, which is that there are proper truths and second-rate useless truths, and the proper truths are the ones that have truth makers, and then all these negative things like there are no hobbits, there are no Marianne, there's no Joseph Stalin in Oxford, you know, they're not the truths about the world, they're parasitic truths on how the world is, something like that. So there are just two levels of truth. So I'm getting a truth maker for the actual truths. And then it's up to you to have a theory for what negations of those truths mean. That's what you I'm voting for, but it's.
I think mine relates to the first question. You said the truth makers have truth makers. I didn't quite understand that.
Oh. Yes. I'll come up with an example. You know, sort of. I mean, Marianne is in Scotland. What's Scotland? You know, sort of, well, you have a truth maker, a chunk of land there. Who's Marianne? You know, sort of, I'm sorry, I can't give you a good example, but it's just that obviously you're going to...
I accept that truth makers are states of affairs.
This connects with Mike's question, because I see your point. I mean, there's a truth maker. If I say there's a truth maker in a state of affairs, and the state of affairs is the truth makers, there would only be a hierarchy if there were truths about those states of affairs. So actually, I think, yes, I'm probably going to have to slightly reformulate how I put this. But certainly, I mean, the notion that one truth depends on another doesn't sound very controversial, does it?
Yeah, but I thought we had two things. Truths, statements, propositions, and states of affairs were the truth makers.
Yes.
Now, I can understand how a proposition can have a number of truth makers, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
Because different states of affairs could correspond to that proposition. But how a state of affairs could have series of truth makers, I'm not quite sure.
I'm sort of half conceding your point. When I reformulate my theory and bring it back to you, you will have to see that it's extremely good theory, but at the moment you've made a good point.
my question is, I thought it was a famous fact, but it wasn't actually. Did you say you talked about experience, that the truth maker, the beautiful, say, Verna sitting there, if you say Verna is sitting there, the truth maker is your experience of Verna sitting there, or would you say that it's, that the truth maker is Verna sitting there?
Well, I'm loosely saying the state of affairs of Verna sitting in that chair.
Yeah, and the minute you say state of affairs, the state of affairs is a kind of abstraction, isn't it?
It's not a precise thing, but I mean, I'm trying to pick up, it's a situation in reality, it's not anything else. It's not a description, it's fact, you know, the fact.
It's the
way the world is. The way the world is, I mean, that's what this whole theory is, you know, truths are parasitic on the way the world is, that's the story.
You have to be quite careful how you phrase it, because you'll end up with a problem of the correspondence theory where you've got two sets of abstract objects that you're trying to work out what the relation is. You want an asymmetric relation, don't you?
Well, the phrase state of affairs contains abstract words, but I mean, it's not meant to pick out, it's like the word radiator is a kind of, it's a universal, the world is full of radiators, but I mean, that doesn't make a radiator abstract.
I'm on your side, but I'm worrying about getting out of the kind of problem that all the linguistic philosophers are going to throw at us. Okay.
We've heard that somewhere.
We've had time to just wait, and it's going to have to be very, very quick.
You say that true is open, and basically, but you are trying to justify it as truth is a tautological truth. So you are sitting, I can see it, so it's evidence, and that makes it true. However, it's highly dependable of direct contact that makes the true maker kind of evident and true. And that generates all the shame that you are trying to establish, like cycle, order. However, in social situations where the true makers are established by two different situations, I'm going to establish one, like, for example, in the Second War, when by using propaganda, there were two true makers that were established, and you said in part of your document that if I believe it, basically it has a relevance and can be true. How does the truth work there? I mean, there are many situations where the truth makers are not evident, are not tautological, and how can we find the truth there?
Yes, I'm trying to sort of pick the way through the question. I mean, you're citing a case of propaganda, which is almost a definition of persuading people to believe something that's false. Insofar as, I mean, it's not a very precise thing, but insofar as I'm offering a sort of waffle detector in this theory, it's a way for you to go up to Dr. Goebbels and say when you say that, you know, so and so is the case in, you know, British people eat babies or something, what is the truth maker for your claim? And it's precisely a means of challenging it and challenging the media, you know, putting your hand up in a political meeting and saying, excuse me, future Prime Minister, what is the truth maker for this extraordinary claim you're making? So it's meant to cut through this stuff. And if there's a, you know, and you can have all sorts of social relativistic sort of notions of truth, where a whole bunch of people agree on something, and some people would say that's all you need for truth, but I wouldn't, because I want to track it back to the real world. You know, all truths are rooted in the real world, is the story I'm telling. So it's precisely trying to give you a reason why propaganda is to be avoided. But I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes. You might as well have another question. You've got other questions. I need to set up the power, so you might as well carry on.
Yes. Can I just ask you if I've answered his question?
I just think that the truth is not just doesn't go entirely to the what we call real world. It comes as well from the idea that we created. I mean, if we truth is an entirely human creation, and what we put as the background to it, in the society was just an example, but are a highly abstract concepts that are behind it. Just the idea of democracy, you are not going to find that idea in the natural world, in the ordinary real world.
Well, you're opening a can of worms, but roughly I think I am. There's going to be the only problem case I've mentioned is negative truths. But you're citing others. There are generalizations, things like laws of nature, abstractions, mathematics, logic, all these sort of things. How do they fit with that? And that would be, I just haven't got time to go into that. But personally, I would want to tell a story about how these all gradually track back to the real world. So there's a single metaphysical picture I want to sell. It sounds to me as if you and I actually disagree about what truth is. I mean, it sounds as if you think truth is a sort of social construct. I think truth is actually created by the world, you know, which is perhaps a rather unusual view, in the sense that I utter propositions and the world makes them true. We don't make them true, so maybe we completely disagree.
Okay.
Time? Yeah. Okay.